Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Joining me today is Jill Winebanks and Morgan Cloud. Jill is an author, MSNBC legal analyst, and podcast host. She was the first woman to serve as an organized crime prosecutor at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Just 4 years later, she was selected to be one of three assistant Watergate special prosecutors in the obstruction of justice trial against President Nixon's top aides. You should absolutely read her book, Watergate Girl, to learn about that experience. Jill was also in the organized crime section at Justice when the RICO law passed. Morgan is a Charles Howard Candler Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law, located in Atlanta, Georgia. Morgan has been working with RICO statutes since 1975 because Bob Blakey, the primary architect of the original federal statute, was his teacher and also his boss in law school. Before joining the Emory faculty, he was a trial lawyer and litigator in Florida and California, and he litigated cases throughout the United States. He writes and teaches about white-collar crime, constitutional criminal procedure, and digital privacy. In addition to publishing in prestigious academic journals, Professor Cloud has also taught courses in Germany, Hungary, and France. Before our conversation, there are a few things I want to mention. While we spoke, we went into great detail about the RICO statute, and Morgan had some inside knowledge about why it was called RICO. And as you may know, the federal statute, the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, has a lot of state analogs. So right, Georgia, the statute, Georgia RICO statute under which Donald Trump and 18 others were charged about 10 days ago, is also the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act. It's really hard to say and it's really awkward, but we know it as RICO. And I think a lot of us have always wondered why it was called that. And Morgan explained it to us. It was because his boss, Bob Blakey, the law professor who designed the statute, came up with the word RICO and then the name of the statute later. And we see this all the time with laws where someone will come up with a clever name like the Jobs Act, which was a law to loosen up on regulations of securities offering. But you call it the Jobs Act because it sounds like it's creating jobs. It was a Jumpstart Our Businesses Startups Act. So Morgan was right. It does appear that the name of the statute was from a gangster movie, but it was not Scarface, but it was the film Little Caesar, starring Edward G. Robinson as the lead character, gangster Caesar Enrico Bendello, known as RICO. And after that film, he was cast often in the role of a tough guy. So that makes a lot of sense. The film came out in 1931, and it would have been on folks' minds in the late 60s, early 70s, by the time this statute was enacted. Since today we are talking about a book for the Booked Up book club, you might wonder why in the world Donald Trump is the subject of the club. You know, he is not known to be a big reader or even an author. You know that his most popular book, Art of the Deal, was ghostwritten by Tony Schwartz. So why in the world would we have this book club episode focusing on him? Well, it's not a book. It's more like a booking photo because today when I'm recording, he is getting booked up at the Fulton County Jail. Yes, we recorded this episode on Thursday, August 24th, just hours before Mr. Trump was scheduled to surrender at that Georgia jail. He will be there to answer to 13 charges brought by Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis for racketeering charges and more in connection with his failed efforts to overturn the presidential election results in 2020. Unlike the three previous indictments, Yes, it's astonishing even to say that out loud. Unlike those three previous indictments, the former president this time will be treated like any other criminal defendant. While he has been previously fingerprinted, this time he will have a booking photo taken and will be required to pay a $200,000 cash bail. He is one of 19 defendants charged this time in a sweeping 98-page, meticulously manicured indictment. This is beyond uncharted territory. We are off the map. A former president now faces 91 felony counts across four indictments, and he is running for re-election. Just to keep score, in March of this year, 2023, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg charged him with 34 counts of falsifying business records in connection with hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. Then in June, Special Counsel Jack Smith with the Department of Justice charged Trump with 37 felonies in connection with his willful retention of national security information. And those charges also include obstruction, false statements, and destroying or concealing documents, and more. Then, on August 1st, Jack Smith was back, charging Trump with four federal felonies in connection with efforts to overturn the presidential election in 2020. And this included conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. Today, with Jill and Morgan, we are zeroing in on the Fulton County RICO case. Okay, let's dive in. Hey guys, it's so good to have you together on this momentous day.
It is a momentous day, a sad day, because we're going to now see a mugshot of the former and possibly future president of the United States.
Why did you have to say future, Jill? You're such a realist.
I am a realist. I'm sorry, it's possible. I think it's unlikely and horrifying, but it's within the realm of the possible. I watched the debate last night. Did you?
I indeed did. I had done, Jill, I'd done a local news show. They called me to talk about what we might expect. And so I had to, after I had talked about that, I had to actually watch it. I admit I did fall asleep for part of it. So, hey, Morgan, why are you laughing? Did you watch the debate last night?
I saw enough to have a renewed appreciation for the former governor of South Carolina. That's all I can say. That'd be my best positive take was.
So you think Nikki Haley did better than the others?
I know. I just think she said some rational things.
Yeah, so. I think.
What a low bar we have set. She said something rational.
Yeah.
Did anybody see the New York Times graph? I don't know what it looked like in the newspaper, but online, where mm-hmm. it was rating the performance.
Yes.
And the first graph made it look like DeSantis was the top person because of how they structured it. It was, I guess I'm sort of tempted to write a letter to the editor, because when you go further into the article, it shows the rating, and actually Nikki Haley was rated way above him.
So. And that's they did the rating based on their opinion columnists, right?
Yes.
What I found interesting, I saw that. I also saw, I think CNN, the other network, had some kind of poll where was it, I don't know how many thousands of people, was it 90,000 people somehow voted? And I don't know if it was all, I don't quite understand what their reader, how this worked, but the winner, according to them, was Vivek Ramaswamy. So there you go.
Well, I didn't think he was a winner. He did get a lot of airtime. He did get a lot of attention. So that makes him a winner in a way. His views were appalling. I didn't know all of them before. And now that I do, I'm really frightened that anybody thinks he was the winner. I mean, maybe if you're talking about technical debating skills, he spoke loudly and was heard and got a lot of attention. But in terms of making any points that made any sense, zero. Totally awful.
Obviously, I have a technical question. Which is less reliable, a TV online poll or just an internet online poll? I don't know which one is more useless.
There's no science in either of them. But I think maybe it might have been among people who identify as Republicans, which is a shrinking pool. It's astonishing to me that this is the best they could get, and yet the worst they could get, Donald Trump, who is now quadruply indicted, is the leader of the pack. Some people say that Ramaswamy was auditioning for VP, but there is no way Donald Trump would let this guy be his VP because he would upstage him. He's a younger, more attractive version of him. There's actually has some money. There's no way. But that brings us
and
to...
He talks in complete sentences.
Even if they are from ChatGPT.
I would just say my personal completely unqualified opinion was he was auditioning for being Trump if Trump, for some reason, like getting convicted, does not become the nominee. That's what I thought he was doing.
On the other hand, only two people on the stage said that they would not support him if he were a presidential candidate and indicted.
And let's say who those two people were. Who were they, Jill?
Asa Hutchinson and Chris Christie are the only two who said they would not support a convicted candidate.
And how many would pardon him? I don't remember what that
was. Well, Ramaswamy said he would. I think all of them, except, of course, for the two who wouldn't even vote for him, said that. So, yeah, I mean...
Which is the significance, isn't it, of the Georgia prosecution?
It is part of the significance, yes.
A nice segue, and I'm gonna let us do that. But before we do that, I want to ask. I didn't ask where everybody was. I always like to know that. So, where are you seated right now, Morgan?
I'm seated at my desk in my Emory office, which in 24 more hours I will be out of after more than 40 years. So it's a big day for me. I appreciate the show because you've taking me away from packing books into boxes. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. It's such a much better thing to see you two and talk to you two.
Thank you very much. And have you, I mean, that is a low bar, but I'll take it. I'll take a compliment when I hear one. Are you discovering any things that as you're packing up, like tucked behind a shelf yet, that bring back memories that make you pause?
I found a photograph of the Emory Law School faculty entry team in a corporate competition from fundraising event from 1983. It was shocking. It was shocking. And not just for me. I mean, obviously it was shocking to look at me, but everybody else was pretty shocking too. So,
but aren't there photos on the faculty webpage, the same photos from that anyway?
No, we have a very 19th century tech operation here. So there's none of that.
And Jill, where are you?
I'm in my living room, and outside is 104 degrees, and that's in Chicago. 104 here. Yes, it's 104.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. We hardly ever get to 100. We hardly even ever get into the 90s. Luckily, it's been 2 days in a row. But tomorrow it's supposed to break. So I am hoping for that because yesterday and today was like walking into a sauna when you left the house.
That's so weird because just across Lake Michigan, where my family is, I was just visiting there, they just had some kind of rainstorm.
So, you know, I saw that on the weather thing about hail. Did they get hail?
I don't know, but my mother sent me an article about how the roads to the airport were all flooded. So I guess it indicates, without a note, I was lucky to get out, maybe is what she was saying.
Wow. Well, it's been pretty tense and horrible here because of the weather.
Well, I'm glad that you are air conditioned inside because you look lovely as usual, especially that pin. Can you talk to me about what you are wearing on your left lapel?
Well, since we're going to talk about at least the Georgia indictment, this is a reproduction of the first federal indictment, the Mar-a-Lago documents case. And it is, you know, it's got the blue back because it's a federal indictment and they come in blue backs. And then indictment is written widely across it. And I have debated whether I'm willing to pay for three more indictment pins to replicate the other three criminal cases. And then would I have to do some of the civil cases? I have to think about that because, you know, E. Jean Carroll would certainly deserve two pins, not just one. And Letitia James would deserve a pin. And so then you get into, I'm not sure how many pins I'm willing to have that say indictment on it.
Some thoughts, though. I mean, I was once a Girl Scout, you know, and you get that green sash and your patches.
Oh, I was a Girl Scout too. Absolutely. That could be really fun.
Were you a Boy Scout, Morgan?
I was a really terrible Boy Scout. I have a brother who I have a brother who became an Eagle Scout, but it was he was a much more diligent person than I.
Well, the thing I liked best about Girl Scouts was, number one, banana boats, which is slightly different. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
That's my favorite.
Oh, you're bringing it back. Wait, describe those.
Oh, my God. It's you take a banana, you peel back just one part of it, you scoop out a little bit of the banana, you stuff it.
When you say this, let me just describe it. You're peeling out one section lengthwise of
the length of it along, and then you stuff it with chocolate Hershey little squares and marshmallow, which you either have to use minis or you have to cut them in half because there weren't minis when I was a Girl Scout, I don't think. So we cut them up and then you put the peel back on it, wrap it in tinfoil and throw it in the fire. It's better than s'mores, although those are very good too. And the other thing was Camp CEO, which I have recently done. It is
what?
It's something new. I went to Girl Scout camp as well as being a Girl
Me
Scout.
Me too.
Oh, good. Did you go to which one?
In the Midwest? Well, I'm from Michigan. Yeah, so.
Oh, I went to one somewhere. I think it was in Illinois, but it could have been Wisconsin.
It had cabins. It wasn't terrible. Yeah. It wasn't
like
tents.
No, it was wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Nice.
But they now have something called Camp CEO where they invite back, you don't have to be a former Girl Scout, although I was, they invite senior executives and professionals who your commitment is to stay overnight at the camp and to agree to mentor one of the campers who are specially selected outstanding Girl Scouts. And I am still close with one of the mentees I had. I did this several years. And one of them is now got her master's degree in divinity from Harvard and is a chaplain at Tufts Hospital, where she has been all throughout the COVID crisis.
Wow.
And she's an amazing human being and an amazingly interesting person and caring and wonderful.
I want to talk about all these nice things, but our job today is to talk about not camp CEO, but club fed and prison.
Or it
won't be club fed. It will be the Fulton County Jail. So let's pivot to that, to someone who should have had better mentoring as a child, and that is Donald John Trump. So I think I'd like to talk about what's happening right now. And Jill, tell us a little bit about the latest news in terms of Fani Willis's trial date. What is going on? I thought this trial was going to go kind of well after the first. I thought this was going to go well after the documents case, but the second Jack Smith case involving the
coup
insurrection.
Yeah.
The conspiracy, conspiracy to defraud the United States. That I thought that case would go first. Tell us what's going on. There's some breaking news.
There is breaking news, and I'm not sure how it's going to end up. But as of right now, October 23rd, this year, just a few months from now, is
before Halloween. Unbelievable.
Yes, and Halloween is a great holiday. My favorite. It will be October 23rd for at least Chesbro, and maybe others. So he not only got an early trial date by asking for the Speedy Trial Act to be invoked, which in Georgia means that it has to be within 60 days of the session that is now going on or the next session. And that next session ends October 31st. So
I see.
There's like it's not flexible, basically.
Is that when it has to? Does the Georgia Speed Trial Act say it has to be completed or started?
Started.
Okay.
Great. Yeah. Georgia has it with a very odd rule, because unlike most jurisdictions that have like a time frame or something like that, it's got a two-term rule.
Yeah.
And right now we're in the July term. The September term starts next week.
When you say term, you mean grand jury term
grand
or trial
term?
No, the term of the Superior Court, trial court.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the September term starts next week. And then the November term starts in November, I think Monday, November 6th, something like that. And under the Georgia two-term rule, this trial has to be started before the November term starts. And so Ms. Willis, with the what seems to be the typical planning that her office has shown, has given themselves about a week and a half leeway by picking October 23rd. I mean, these people know what they're doing. And I'll tell you one other thing that's really interesting about Georgia. You know, I think that Jill will know more about this than I would be. You know, we know that there are going to be motions for severance and so on. But the Georgia law has a pretty strong presumption that one of multiple defendants invokes the statutory right. And that's all I have to do. Now Mr. Chesbrough's entitled. They like to tie everybody together. Now, I'm sure Jill can go on and on about how unlikely that is to happen. But I mean, it's a really interesting development that I've talked about this in the media in the last few weeks. I've just been waiting for somebody to do this because this is going to be really interesting.
So Morgan,
and today, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Jen. It's your show. You get to talk.
Yeah. So it's today. This is airing when people hear this. It's going to be Sunday. Today it's the Thursday, the 24th of August, and so we knew that that Chesbrough had made the motion that Fannie Willis had said, fine, it will be October 23rd. Mm-hmm. And then the judge also said, let's do it.
Yes.
We also know that before the judge blessed it, Donald Trump filed a motion to sever. What is this? Can you talk about motions to sever and how likely it would be granted? And if it's not granted, are we really is everyone going to be on trial October 23rd?
You know, there is a presumption. I think Morgan was going there. People indicted together should be tried together. It's judicial efficiency. Otherwise, you have the same evidence and the same witnesses having to be called 19 different times if you had 19 potential cases. I think there is something else to be considered, which is how you fit 19 defendants and their lawyers and the prosecutors in the well of the court. In Watergate, we used the ceremonial courtroom at the federal court in D.C., which was the biggest court available. And we had wall-to-wall tables, chairs, people. And that was before we had computers. I mean, this was what we used, as Morgan is now learning as he packs up, you know, paper files. And it was, anyway, there was not a room for another defendant. And we only had five in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting to see how they will rebuild a courthouse or, you know, and I know she's had some RICO cases with multiple defendants, almost that number. I also don't think there will be 19 because I believe many of them will end up flipping. They'll take a plea deal. They, especially once they see the Fulton County Jail, they're going to not want to serve any time there. It's one thing to go in and get fingerprinted and mugshot, another thing to spend overnight there. So I don't think. And then I would have thought that every defendant other than Trump would ask for severance on the grounds that being tried with him would present hurdles in terms of security and would have presented hurdles in terms of being linked to him one way or the other, that it could be end up being favorable because you get a Trumper on the jury, or it could be very unfavorable. So I don't think they'll end up being 19 tried together. And there is a presumption, though, that once one has made the motion for a speedy trial, that all will get the speedy trial, but they can waive their speedy trial right. They don't have to accept it.
Can I jump in with a couple of local knowledge things? One is the famous Atlanta Public Schools RICO case that Ms. Willis tried as an assistant district attorney with the assistant of her, with the assistance of John Floyd, who again is her RICO expert in this case, and I'm sure has something to do with that fabulous response they filed in federal court yesterday on the removal issue. That case, they originally indicted something like 23 people, about 11 pled out, but they went to trial with 12 defendants.
Yeah.
And I agree with very much with what Jill said. It's hard to see that all 19 of these people have the wherewithal, whether it's money or energy or commitment, to stand through this process. So I think I really am not one of those people who thinks the size of the courtroom will end up being an issue. I don't think it is. I do think, however, that it's a big issue for the prosecution. One of the things that I love about this indictment, I think it's, again, John Floyd's fingerprints are all over it. But one of the things that's wonderful about this indictment is it tries to show, okay, there are violations of Georgia law, and they fit under this racketeering conspiracy concept because, and especially because, they're part of this much bigger picture. And so one of the reasons that Ms. Willis and her team, I think, will fight hard to keep as many people in one trial as possible is because that allows them to paint the picture, the broad picture, the big picture they're trying to develop. And then one more thing, when Jill and I went the era when we went to law school, before RICO, there was still a lot of controversy about big conspiracy cases. And I'm sure, Jill, you may remember way back reading from those 1940s conspiracy cases from the Supreme Court. But one of the things they talked about was the spillover effect. How if you've got 12 people sitting in a courtroom with their lawyers on one side, and then you got the prosecutor on the other side, and the long trial, everybody begins to associate all the one side of the room with each other, and it can be hard to remember what evidence was used against what person. And so I think that's a classic reason the defendants want a severance. And it's a classic reason, particularly in this case, I think that the prosecution is going to fight hard to have as big a panel of defendants as they can when they go to trial.
Yeah, I definitely think they will fight hard and that they will prevail. It is very unwise to have individuals tried and try to separate out the evidence. But it is definitely possible in a big conspiracy to, in closing, say, this is the evidence of the violation of this statute by this person and this person and this person. This is the next count, and here's the evidence against each of the individuals. It's very, very possible. Juries pay very close attention, and I don't think that's going to be a problem. And the burden for severance would be on them to convince that judicial administration isn't outweighed by whatever their reasons are. And I can't think of any reasons.
Hold on, Jill. You said the burden is on them, but them is an indefinite pronoun.
Sorry. It would be on the movant, the defendants in this case, moving for severance. They would have to establish certain parameters, reasons for a severance. And I don't think they can meet the standard that's required here.
Certainly you wouldn't want to sever the head of the serpent. Donald Trump has to be part of this. I would think that in terms of what's so nice about this particular indictment as well is that there are certain people that you really don't want to sever, even if they seem like minor characters. However, there are some sort of overlaps. You don't necessarily need all of these defendants to make the case. Like, I definitely would want the woman who was brought in there to intimidate Ruby Freeman.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain people that you definitely want in there because the jury is going to just completely focus in on what they say. And then there are others, again, you know, how many of these people who helped submit or were fake electors do you actually need? And that, of course, would depend on, I don't know how they are going to appear on the stand. You know, there's all this other factors, and I'm sure that she's thought about that.
I'm sure, but you wouldn't want to sever some number of them and keep one in, because you'd be trying that case multiple times, and that would be such a waste. And I also think that in terms of if the former president does get severed, you still would have every bit of evidence that relates to him as part of anybody else's case, because he is a co-conspirator, and therefore evidence against him is admissible against all the others. And so it's not going to be a killer in terms of the other defendants being tried. They would still be stuck with the person that they conspired with. And, in Watergate, it was an unindicted co-conspirator, Nixon, whose tapes and other evidence was really crucial to the prosecution. And it was fully admissible because he was named a co-conspirator.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
So I want to, since you mentioned Watergate, obviously that went down before... I mean, I've heard of it. No, I'm kidding. That went down before.
I was
alive then, and I was very excited about it. So when Watergate happened, though, that was before there was the federal RICO statute, and both of you have experience working with the federal RICO statute that was enacted in 1970, and I want to ask you about that because there's a lot of hype around it, a lot of misinformation. And I hope that you can talk about what your experience was and why it improved the ability to bring, for example, federal charges against whole organizations that wasn't really there with, a 371, a traditional conspiracy statute. I want to start with you, Morgan, because I think you worked for the guy who wrote the statute.
Yeah, and I think we've established by email today, he had a big impact on my career and Jill's career. Bob Blakey, a professor in law school of mine, and a former Senate committee lawyer, is credited with being the primary author of writing the original federal RICO statute. I will tell you one anecdote that Bob has told me more than once, and I hope it's true because it's so wonderful. When he was growing up, he said one of his favorite movies was a movie called Scarface. and there's a famous, not the recent
no,
one.
No, I saw the old one. I did, for film class. Yeah.
Yeah. And the main character, his classic line at the end of the movie is this the end of RICO? Bob Leahy told me, and I'd take him in his face because he's a pretty honest guy, that he came up with this awkward, weird name, Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organization, so he could call it RICO.
Wait a second. Yeah. Are you kidding?
I'm not kidding. I'm not saying it happened. I'm just saying that's what Bob told me more than once. So
there's a lot going on here, and I just love it. Jill Winebanks is so popular that she has to answer her phone on a podcast, and we are not cutting that out. Because we are Cinema Verite. Do not apologize. But holy smoke! So the classic black and white Scarface movie. It was one of the first talkies, right?
Edward G. Robinson was RICO, I think, wasn't he? Wasn't Edward G. Robinson? I think anyway.
That is such a great story, and I don't even want to look it up because I think it's true.
You don't want to verify it because what if it's not true? Then you can
use
it.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you had this law professor and the statute. What was the reason why, in terms of legislative history, Congress felt the need for this? I mean, I know it partially federalizes state law crimes, but why not just use why not just use the wire fraud or mail fraud or conspiracy? Why was this statute? What does it do? What kind of muscle does it have that the law did not have until that time?
Well, that's a half a semester in my white collar crime class using your book, Jen. So I think we do. That's clearly our longest section in the course. But I want to talk about it in a kind of an unusual way, at least I'm not used to hearing this, but in a way that I think is really relevant to understanding RICO's application to this current political mess we've got. one of the driving motivations for the Kefauver and McClellan Senate committees back in the 50s and 60s, and Mr. Blakey and Bobby Kennedy, his co-staff lawyer on the Senate committee, one of the things they were really concerned about was that the growth in power and wealth of organized crime was being used to infiltrate legitimate businesses, infiltrate government activities, and really corrupt democracy. And it was organized crime didn't just amount to, you know, John Gotti getting some corrupt money. It really was a threat to the very fabric of our democratic capitalist society. So the statute is not written in a way that in any way really goes after mobsters per se. I think Jill will probably agree. I mean, you will too, Jim, that the only place racketeer appears in the statute, federal or Georgia, is in the title. And the word mobster never appears. The word gang never appears because I don't know if you could possibly do have those terms in there and have the statute withstand constitutional challenge. I don't know how you define some. So what they did, and what Bob Blakey's wonderful insight was, is we'll define racketeering in terms of specific listed identified crimes that are carried out in certain ways. And, you know, we all know that in relationship to an enterprise and in a pattern of racketeering activity. Right. And there's some other complications too. But the basic idea was we're going to define racketeering in terms of crimes and crimes of a certain sort. So the original federal statute does list about half a dozen categories of state crimes, and then it lists dozens of federal crimes. And in the origin, you know, they tended to be the kinds of crimes that were attributed to organized criminal activity, but not solely. So, for example, and I'm sure that Jill, looking back, I mean, I think, Jill, if I were you, I'd look back and say, why didn't we charge RICO obstruction in Watergate? Because obstruction of justice can be conducted by anybody, and it's under the federal statute, a racketeering predicate act. And right. So, you know, and so the statute very quickly morphed into something completely different from what, like Rudy Giuliani likes to say, I don't know, we went after the New York mob, and they did. And it was effective in those settings against those families. But the statute was not written with that limitation. I mean, within, you know, in the early 80s, I had early litigation in California accusing one of the, I was on the plaintiff's side, a huge financial institution of racketeering under civil RICO. And because it was so obvious, the statute was written to be much broader than just getting the Gambinos.
It's funny. I know Nixon resigned in 74, and I know Watergate was in 72, the break-in, and I know that, but for some reason I had like in my head 68 for when Nixon ran for office, but of course RICO was around.
He ran again in 72.
But right. Nixon signed it into law. He was president of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1970 or whatever it was.
Right, and it was a subsection of that, a subtitle or whatever. So Jill, you when you were at the Justice Department, you used RICO.
Yes.
Did you only use it in the organized crime space or did you use it in other arenas?
Well, I was in the organized crime space, so that's what my job was. And Bob Blakey was also responsible for Title III, which allowed legal intercepts, the application for a warrant to a judge proving probable cause to believe that the phone was being used in connection with a crime. And so our group, which was pretty small then, were the first to use RICO and Title III. My memory, this is really irrelevant to all this, but the first Title III tape was being played at an organized crime section meeting. And Henry Peterson, who later got involved, unfortunately, in Watergate, but was a very revered and wonderful figure at that time, started to play it and suddenly looked up and paused the tape and said, "Oh, Jill, we'd all understand if you'd like to leave. There's some very harsh language on this tape." I was the only woman in the room. And so, of course, I was being told I could leave because my delicate ears must burn if I heard the language that the mob used. Little did he know that I would then be listening to White House tapes with worse language. So anyway, I didn't leave the room. I stayed.
When you use the word legal intercept, is that a blanket term including wiretapping?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yep. It sounds fancy. So you, when using, since you have used this at the federal level and you both are familiar with that, when you saw some of the states, not all of them, have their own mini RICOs, we've heard a lot about how different the Georgia RICO statute is from the federal one. In my mind, some of the best ways to describe how the federal one works, I suppose better than just using a ordinary federal conspiracy statute, is that you're able to bring in a whole range of criminal behavior and charge multiple defendants with that behavior, even if it is not, even if they did not enter into an agreement to engage in a particular criminal objective. In other words, if Jill and I decided, you know, enough of this podcasting, we want to become drug dealers, and we enter into an agreement that we're going to start dealing some, I don't even know what drug it would be, you know, some drug called, bubblegum. And we're going to do this. And I say, Jill, we've got to do this. We can make so much money. But before we can do this bubblegum dealing, I think we both need to buy some masks and, you know, so that no one can recognize our faces. So could you go out to, you know, Costco and buy some? And if Jill goes out to the car, you know, we've got our act in furtherance. And then if she decides to go out and go buy the bubblegum and deal it to people, even if I had nothing to do with the bubblegum dealing, because we entered into this agreement, any of this bubblegum dealing that she does and anything, maybe even some money laundering that she does in furtherance of this objective, I could be charged with those things. So if she flips on me, right? Okay. But the difference with RICO, it seems like it's bigger than that, because instead, if Jill and I, RICO would be more like if Jill and Morgan and I have a lot of dirty money that we have, you know, the proceeds came from this old crime of bubblegum dealing, and we decide to buy up, you know, a few, you know, a gas station, and we decide to buy up a little like a part, you know, a liquor store. We buy these things with the proceeds of that money. And then we continue, you know, if we do that, even if Morgan isn't involved in the crimes that we commit, the bubblegum crimes, even if he never agreed to that, if he's participating and operating, if he's managing one of the liquor store for us, he is now part of a RICO enterprise. In other words, it's a very much bigger, I'm not kind of doing it good service, but it feels like you can get people who didn't agree to a criminal conspiracy to be charged if they're participating in or running or controlling what's known as a RICO enterprise, which is, it could be just something where you use the proceeds of crime to run it, or it could be something where you're operating it, you're shaking people down using those. Am I getting this right, Jill?
I think you're getting it right, although I think that 371 conspiracy could be broader than
Morgan.
That broader than you're giving it credit for. I think RICO allows multiple conspiracies within the overarching conspiracy. So you have the conspiracy to overturn the election, and then you have all these separate conspiracies to commit forgery, to commit pressure on the Secretary of State to, you know, create the fake electors, which probably related to the forgery. And all of those then become part of the big RICO conspiracy.
I see. So they get rolled up into one. Yeah. Unlike I'm going back to the Mueller report, for example, like when they said there wasn't enough evidence of an agreement between the Russians, that's like Donald Trump and others, Donald Trump Jr. and others at the Trump Towers to interfere in the election. We know there was parallel activity. Let's say there had been an agreement there they could establish, and let's say there was an agreement somewhere else, you could roll it all into an agreement to help him win the election. Here we have that case passed us by, but here we have in Georgia this idea that all these things you're saying get rolled up into one RICO conspiracy. Okay.
So how is Georgia?
Yeah, Morgan.
One of the things that's what's so significant about this indictment compared to the other indictments so far relating to this election interference. And again, one of the reasons I think that I said earlier, I think that the prosecutors are going to want to try as many people together as possible. An example of what you two were just discussing is the racketeering acts and the acts in furtherance of the conspiracy to violate RICO alleged in charge one of this indictment include phone calls and meetings with legislators in Pennsylvania and people, the leader of the Republican House in Arizona, as well as people breaking into government computers in rural Coffee County, Georgia, and the chief of staff flying into Cobb County and trying to get into a room where vote signatures are being authenticated. How do those all fit together into a conspiracy? And one of the beauties of the RICO statute that you two have just explained is it allows Bonnie Willis and her team to put together a picture of saying, this is how these are all part of the same deal.
Right. And to go outside her outside her jurisdiction, because you mentioned Coffee County. She can't prosecute crimes in Coffee County, but she can because she has the overarching conspiracy happening in Fulton County.
Yeah. And then under the Georgia RICO statute, there's venue in any county where racketeering acts are committed. So if you're a member of the racketeering conspiracy and you're in Coffee County, there's still venue against you in Atlanta, in Fulton County.
Or if you live in Pennsylvania, there's still.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Is there anything else that makes the Georgia state RICO easier to use that you're aware of than the federal?
Yeah, I can give you a bunch.
Oh, give us a bunch. I'd like to know.
The most obvious one is the main essential category of conduct listed under the RICO charge is making false statements and submitting false documents or false writings. That is not a RICO predicate act under the federal statute. It is predicate act under the Georgia statute. It's explicitly listed, and there are some really interesting Georgia appellate court cases applying and interpreting the role of false statements in the RICO statute in Georgia. So right away, the whole structure, the phone call to Mr. Raffensperger on January 2nd of 2021 might not be indictable, except it's a false statement, except as right. A false statement. And so just that difference, that is the definition of crimes, the state saying this is a crime that we want our RICO statute to cover, makes it a completely different animal for this case. I mean, it's as if the RICO statute for Georgia, which was drafted enacted in 1980, were designed with this case in mind, it seems to me.
It reflects the reason for the original RICO at the federal level, which was focused on organized crime. So the crimes that were predicate acts were murder, arson, the kind of things that
shakedown, like extortion and bribery,
the things we thought that And by the way, back then, it was called either the Mafia or La Cosa Nostra. LCN was what we used to call it. So
I have a procedural question before I talk about how this case might move forward. So going back to Cheeseboro, can he suddenly say, you know, oh, my bad. I really don't want to. I want to waive that after all.
I think that I have heard, and I didn't research this, so it's not based on independent research, that once you've invoked it, you cannot uninvoke it. But Morgan, you're more a Georgia expert. Tell us whether that is correct.
I could truthfully say, as a Georgia expert, I don't know the answer. But I would say that, you know, I think that people can, unless there's some kind of heavy government reliance, I can't imagine someone not being allowed under advice of counsel and being advised by the judge, not be able to change their mind on waiving a right. I just think this was a very intentional choice. I think this must have been something he and his lawyers thought about and talked about and debated about before doing it. So I don't have any sense that this could possibly be off the cuff. I think this was a really strong tactical decision, and there could be lots of reasons for it. But I would never say never ever in the law, let alone in the law of Trump world. But,
well, Trump has said he does not want a speedy trial. He does not agree to that date. So he's gotten a severance for sure. So I have a question. You mentioned lawyers. Can I ask a question?
Wait. You said you think he's going to get a severance, Trump?
He's asked for a severance.
Yes.
But I think that because if the case against Cheeseboro goes forward on that date, he gets a severance. He's severed from the others if the others do not agree to waive their right to a speedy trial, because that has been set by Judge McAfee as the trial date. So they have to be severed if the others won't waive their right. They cannot be forced to go.
Oh, you can't be forced. I'm sorry. I thought you could be forced. They have to agree to it, is what you're saying.
If they say we want to waive our right, they haven't waived it yet. And I think that that would be possibly granted so that he could end up being the sole defendant on that particular date.
Interesting.
And regardless of the technical law, there are so many political issues involved with forcing these particular people to this trial very quickly. I mean, I just think that the hydraulic pressure on the judge and the system to allow people to sever in this case, I think it's going to be whatever Georgia law says almost seems not binding to me, because this is going to be, I don't have to tell you guys, we haven't seen this before is certainly a cliche and an understatement.
What about the removal? Because this is another procedural question. We've had at least two, maybe three people go to federal court and file notices of removal. And those, I think some hearings are happening this Monday.
Yes.
What are the likelihood that the federal judge will say, sure, let's just, we'll try these cases in federal court, not in state court?
I think D.A. Willis has made very convincing arguments as to why there should not be removal. The rights of Georgia have been violated. The election in Georgia at the federal level was violated. And, you know, it's important for people to know that even if it was removed, the prosecutors would be the same and the law would be the same. It would be under Georgia law and the pardon law would be the same. It would be whether there would be procedurally cameras in the courtroom, I don't know. But there could be an argument made that state law should apply and cameras should be allowed. So I think, again, the burden is high on the person asking for this to prove certain things that I don't think they can prove. But I didn't get to ask my question about lawyers.
Oh,
and
go ahead.
I wanted to ask about what you think about this last-minute switch of lawyers. And also, if you know the two lawyers involved, I do not. But he's appearing today with his new lawyer, and the other lawyer has been working for a long time, so I see nefarious delay in this, as I need time to catch up. And since this is the first appearance before a court, the new lawyer is the lawyer of record. So he can't be argued to have already knowledge. So I'm just wondering what you think is the reason You know, was he not paying the original lawyer and the other lawyer wanted out? Was it that he wanted delay? What do you think's going on as to why he switched lawyers?
I'm going to say, I have to say, I now get to institutionally brag. I want to point out that Steve Sadow, the new defense lawyer, Drew Thimbling, his predecessor, Bonnie Willis, John Floyd, and lots of other people involved in this litigation are all Emory Law grads. And why the law school isn't pushing this, I don't know, because this is a world full of Emory law. And for me, as a about to be emeritus professor, Steve Sadow, great lawyer, Drew Findling, excellent lawyer. These are good lawyers. So whatever the reason for making the change, isn't because one lawyer was bad, as we've seen in some situations with Mr. Trump. These are just good lawyers. And whatever happened, I don't think there's going to be a delay. I think that in this case, with the high profile case, with, the no criminal defense lawyer in Atlanta is ignorant of this indictment or the investigation that went on for 2.5 years before. I just cannot see a local judge, state or federal, being very persuaded by that as a delaying tactic, especially Mr. Sadow. He has handled some of the most sophisticated, complicated criminal cases in Atlanta and done very well. And I just think that's not going to be an issue. I do want to talk about removal, though. First of all, I want to suggest to all your listeners and the millions of your listeners that if they go to politico.com and look at today's story about the filings about removal, they'll find a link that anybody can access to the original response to the notice of removal filed by Ms. Willis's team last night. I think it's the best legal pleading I've read in ages. I mean, it is really wonderful. And here's why I say that. Everybody knows that the burden is on Mr. Meadows to show that he was a federal officer, which he was at the time of these events, but also to show that he was acting within the authority of his office. His actions were consistent with his duties and authorities as chief of staff to the president. And so that's his burden. Ms. Willis's pleading and drafted by her team, I think, not only challenges that directly, they take Mr. Meadows' fundamental argument and make it their own. And I know Jill will probably smile at this because this is like a litigator's dream. Oh boy, I get to take. So the argument that Meadows uses, well, this is all protected because I was just doing politics. And to the surprise of everyone, including some former federal prosecutors I saw last night on TV commenting about this, they pull out the Hatch Act, which makes it a federal crime for an executive branch employee like Mr. Meadows or Mr. Trump to interfere with a local election. And so it's just a wonderful pleading. It lays out the law, but it also takes the facts of the case as had been pled by the prosecutor so far and deploys them in just an eviscerating effective way. I mean, it's a wonderful, if you're used to reading legal documents, this is unusually delightful to read.
I agree.
That sounds marvelous. Yeah.
I wish I could have written it. I mean, when we got to the Hatch Act, I went, wow, these guys were ready. They were ready. Yep.
It's sort of what President Biden has done in using some of the Republican attacks against them. And he's used it both in terms of the last night, I'm trying to think what the exact words were, that he is now using as part of a campaign ad, things that they said, which he considers a compliment. And then there was the
accusing
one about
him of being like FDR. That was one of them.
And
last night at the debates, they were complaining about, I think it was Nikki Haley saying how much the Republicans had
spent,
jacked up the budget.
Right, yeah. Right. That's the one that was today. But there was one earlier than that that was just as good. And so the Bidenomics. They were making fun of Bidenomics. And he took, Bidenomics. Here's what it's really doing. But using the Hatch Act was brilliant. Unfortunately, there should have been more prosecutions under the Hatch Act in the Trump administration.
So we only, that is true. I have some names in mind.
Yes, exactly. I'm sure we have the same ones.
Yes. That's for another episode, perhaps. So we only have a few more minutes left. And I'm wondering if you were, I want to have one of you be the prosecutor and one be the defense attorney. Jill, I'm going to make you the prosecutor, and Morgan, I'm going to make defense attorney. And Morgan, how do you, it's like that song from Sound of Music. How do you solve a problem like Maria? How do you defend a scoundrel like the Donald? I mean, how do you defend this guy at this point? Imagine you are now Sato. You're his new counsel. What are the things that you do both inside of court and what needs to be done outside of court to help him? Or is he beyond help?
Well, I'd like to just stop there.
Well, I can give you something that I was told, that when I first went into private practice, one of the first cases I tried was with Jim Neal, who had been the senior person in the Watergate trial. It was Rick Benveniste, Jim Neal, and me. And he said a couple things that are forever valuable, which is never say to a court something your client has said without saying, my client tells me that, so that you're not personally vouching for it. But he also said, you know, there are some cases that even Clarence Darrow couldn't win, because the facts are 100% against you and the law is 100% against you. In most cases, you can pound the table about the facts or the law, but sometimes you just can't win. And I would say in this case, from what the indictment looks like, we haven't seen the proof yet, and we're assuming all of us here, I'm sure, are giving the presumption of innocence that every defendant deserves, and the trial will have to give him due process. From what we've seen in the indictment, it looks like a pretty clear lineup of elements of the crime, evidence to prove those, and credible witnesses to do it, all of whom have, you know, testified publicly, which gives them very good credibility, and which, by the way, is one of the reasons why cameras should be allowed in the federal trials, because there is no danger to the witnesses. They're already known. They've already testified publicly, and the jury, whatever danger they're is posed by Donald Trump and his colleagues, they don't have to be seen. Their names don't have to be known, and the cameras do not have to focus on them. We saw that in the murder trial with Derek Chauvin as the defendant for killing George Floyd. Only the witnesses and the questioning lawyers need to be seen. Even the judge doesn't have to be seen. So I diverted to cameras in the courtroom, but it's a new passion of mine.
Yeah. Yes. I just have one kind of very technical minor point to amplify kind of what Jill was just saying. You try to imagine putting on a defense like, I really thought I won. I honestly, truly, seriously believed I won. As a lawyer, if you start thinking about how does that evidence get put in? Well, people could testify, I told Mr. Trump this, but those would be a whole list of people who are defendants themselves. And how they're going to testify is very complicated if they stay defendants. And Mr. Trump, I think everybody seems to agree, he can't possibly take the stand to say, oh, I really believed it himself, that would be the worst thing he could do. All of a sudden, you think this is his best defense. How do they even present it? And I think that's a problem for someone like Steve Sato. It's like,
what about this? I have an idea. I would do a plea deal. Because he can still run. He could say, look, there was no way I was, okay, this is my idea. There's no way my client can get a fair trial. They're up against him with this nonsense. And he's going to enter a plea. And as long as it doesn't involve it, probation is one of the options, despite I think Fannie Wills at the press conference said it wasn't, but it's an option. Try to get probation and just say, look, I couldn't get a fair trial. And I'm just going to, you know, the American people know what's what, and that, you know, that, you know, Georgia is the place, you know, I'm not saying this, but he'd be saying, you know, Georgia is a place where they made up votes there. Surely they're going to cover that up by trying to indict me. Gets him out with some kind of sweet plea deal, and he runs anyway.
You know, the key word there is deal. You can't make a deal unless somebody will make a deal with you.
So I want to add something to what Morgan said, because even if he believes that he won the election, even if he rejects all evidence to the contrary and doesn't, you know, pay any attention to that, he cannot commit crimes to overturn the result. He can go to court, and he did 60 times, and he lost. He can do things that are legal, but he cannot create fake electors, and he cannot pressure the Secretary of State or the Vice President to violate the Constitution and the Electoral College Act. And there has been, and this hasn't gotten much attention, but there has been a lot of argument made about Hawaii. Have you followed this one?
Oh, yes. I'm old enough to have lived through it, Jill. So 1916. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was alive.
I'm the only one who was born then.
Right. Okay. I'll say that, but it wouldn't be true. But in that case, it was the first time that Hawaii had been admitted as a state and was voting. There was an ongoing recount.
Oh, right.
And the difference was like 415 votes. And at the time, Nixon was the winner. In the end, the recount showed that Kennedy was the winner. And so the Kennedy electors did create what would have to be called fake electoral ballots. You know, they signed on as we're the ones. And the judge in that case did say, it's a good thing you did that, because if you hadn't gotten them in before the deadline, I don't know what I would be doing here. So that it wouldn't have made a difference in the election, because Hawaii had only, I think, two votes at the time. But it is not a relevant example of, yes, we could do it because they did it. There was a reason for their doing it. It was a contested election at the time, and there was nothing contested, legitimately contested, about any of the states that they were creating the slates of fake electors.
And I want to add, in terms of the facts of this matter, the Georgia election results were recounted, I think, three times. They're at least counted three times.
Yes,
and
correct.
Before December 14th, when the electors meet. So it was very different from Hawaii.
And they were certified.
Yeah.
And there were 11,700 separating them, not a few hundred.
That's
a very different kind of
that's
error
right.
Had been.
Very different.
So where does this, as we wrap things up, what are your predictions? What are your predictions about this case? Do you think it will go forward before the federal cases? Do you think Donald will strike a deal? I don't really think he'll do that. How do we move forward through this morass with these four different cases and this leading candidate? That's a legal and a political question, but it's unfathomable for me to even believe where we are and imagine the future.
Well, legally, there's going to have to be some coordination between courts, because there are duplicative witnesses and they can't all be in the same place at the same time. And Donald Trump can only be in one place at a time as well. And he's entitled, even though he waived his right in a civil trial, and he could waive his right in a criminal trial. He doesn't have to be there. As long as he knowingly waives it and the court approves it, he can absent himself. So if he wants to go, you know, campaigning, he can do that instead of being in the courtroom. But on the assumption that he's going to want to be present, they're going to have to schedule these trials so that one starts and ends before the second one starts and ends. And you can't have the witnesses jumping from place to place. So there will be coordination. And at the end of the day, which one comes out first is going to be it's a little unclear to me. It's impossible for me to predict. Will Georgia precede the federal coup indictment? Will Mar-a-Lago precede both of them? Will New York precede either of them? Will E. Jean Carroll get her trial in there? Or will, because it's a civil case and is usually seen as a secondary thing to a criminal case, will that be put off? That would be horribly unfair to her. She's entitled to resolution.
He's not going to come to court anyway, so I think they could probably try that at any time.
Right. That
and it's
is
only
true.
A damages case at this point, given collateral estoppel.
Exactly. So. That's exactly correct. And the damages are going to have to be very high, because the first verdict didn't stop him from creating a second defamation. And part of the reason for the damages was to stop him from doing it. And it didn't work.
Right.
So I'm thinking we're in the billions for this second trial.
So I'm going to have a very non-professional guy. I want to make a movie reference. one of my favorite, one of the classic Val Kilmer lines from the movie Tombstone is, make no mistake, it's not revenge it's after, it's a reckoning. And I think that's what the Georgia case is about. It's a reckoning. And it's only because of the breadth of the pleading and the breadth, the scope of this case. And so I don't know which one's going to come first. I clearly Mr. Cheeseborough is going to get his trial first before anybody else. But beyond that, who knows? But I'm telling you, the Georgia case is the one where he wants a reckoning. And that's the case he's lining up for it. And I think it's going to be incredible theater, drama, and law for all of us.
You know, Morgan, you are the luckiest man on earth because, as you noted, you're about to become emeritus. And there's about to be the trial of the millennium right in your backyard. Are you already planning to line up every morning to watch this case?
Right now I'm mostly, spending most of my time turning down media requests,
we are so honored.
I'm telling you.
Oh my goodness. Thank you.
I mean, it's just, this is great because my retirement seems to be timed perfectly because I think I'll be busy for a little while. I'll have something to do for a while because, the attention is deservedly phenomenal.
Well, how do we find both of you besides on your many media hits that you're not going to be able to turn down eventually, Morgan? Where do people want to find, if they want to find your commentary, where's the best place to look?
Well, on another Politicon podcast last week on the James Carville, Al Hunt. Boy, Al and James are going to be mad at me for this. On Crooked Media, I did a What a Day interview the night of the indictment in Georgia. And then just, stories all over. I'm doing a BBC live show tonight. And so, I'm like everybody else who can stay awake and look at a camera. Somebody wants to talk to you. Somebody wants to talk to you.
Awesome. And Jill, I know you have many venues, but what's the best place to find your work these days?
Well, of course, I am under contract with MSNBC, so that's place number one, but my contract allows me to do certain foreign ones. I do Canadian television, Australian television. I do Stephanie Miller's radio show and others on WCPT, Joan Esposito particularly. I have two podcasts, one hashtag Sisters-in-Law, also produced, of course, by Politicon, as you are, and with Barb McQuaid, Joyce Vance, and Kimberly Atkins-Store. And I do one called iGen Politics, which was originally started as Intergenerational Politics, because I do it with, at the time we started, he was 17, but a superstar, Victor Shee, who's now a leader of young voters. And we try to have conversations that are from intergenerational perspectives. But I'm also on Threads and X and Instagram and Mastodon and Post.
My God. You know what? You actually are a twin or triplets or something, Jill. You are the most energetic, active person. I'm convinced that either you don't sleep or you sleep for a week and then stay awake for a year.
No, I just don't sleep. You got it right the first time. Except I do sleep from like 3 a.m. to 9 or 10. So I do get some sleep in.
That's a good
just
time,
but my brain doesn't work till 10 a.m. So you don't want to ask me to do a morning show. I'm not. Yeah. I'm going to be on tonight. There's a Ali Velshi is having a special tonight. Tonight for us, which won't be for the audience listening. It will be over.
But you it was will have great, it. I'm sure, Jill. So impressive.
It'll be great. And that's at like 10 o'clock my time, 11 o'clock Eastern. And that's a good hour for me because I'm wide awake then.
Well, I look forward to all of your commentary, we've already seen by the time this airs, and also going into the future with this and the other trials. And thank you both for your generosity and being with me today.
Thank you, Jen. And thank you, Morgan. It was actually really, really fun.
No, it was really fun. Thank you both. I enjoyed it a lot.
I love the subtitle of my book is how my fight for truth and justice against a criminal president. Now should say not named Trump. But it was about Nixon. It could be about Trump. So
it really could. Yeah. You know, history rhymes, as they say. We are so fortunate to have Jill Wine Banks and Morgan Cloud together. They are absolute legends to talk about Donald Trump's booking on Booked Up today. I know that you're listening to this on Sunday, and a world of change will have happened between now and then. But as I am speaking, there is on the calendar a major, massive RICO trial with 19 defendants and some, you know, 30-ish unindicted co-conspirators scheduled to begin October 23rd. That's inside of 2 months. Now, will it start then? Will some people be severed from that case? I have no way of knowing, but I will tell you that DA Fani Willis did not come to play, and neither do we here at Booked Up. I'm so glad that you have stuck with us, and we are very excited about the new shows that we're planning for the fall. As you know, or you may know, September and October are when the big books come out. I can't tell you right now who we have lined up because I don't want to jinx anything, but I'm very excited for what is to come this fall. And I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.